Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Takeout ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
But who's counting, right?
His name is Major.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen.
Please welcome Major Garrett.
From the nation's capital.
Major, fantastic.
It's The Takeout.
This is a major achievement.
With CBS News Chief Washington Correspondent.
Major Garrett.
Yes, CBS. Yes, hi.
Major Garrett.
Major, that's nonsense. And you should know better.
Is Major out of the doghouse?
The answer is yes.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. I'm going to start our show off this week with a story. In 1911, something happened called the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire. It was in New York City. Hundreds of women working inside this factory had been asking for better labor conditions unsuccessfully. This building that they worked in had no fire escapes. A fire broke out, and they were trapped. 146 of those workers died in that factory fire. There was a woman named Frances Perkins, who was working on consumer issues at the time, who found this to be an outrage and advocated on behalf of those workers and those who died. That caught the attention of Theodore Roosevelt. Her work continued, and she, because of this advocacy, drew the attention of another Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who appointed Frances Perkins labor secretary. She became the first woman to ever serve as a cabinet secretary in the history of our country until that time. She served for 12 years, becoming the longest serving labor secretary in American history. The Labor Department building here in Washington, D.C. is therefore named after Frances Perkins. In 1995, in a town east of Los Angeles called El Monte, 72 immigrants from Thailand were discovered working in what can only be described as a garment worker factory, but it wasn't a building. It was a series of row houses, which means they worked where they lived, which means they didn't live at all. They just worked. This case came to be recognized as the first defined case of labor slavery in America since we had abolished slavery. And an attorney for an advocacy group took up their cause and propounded what was then a somewhat novel legal theory that garment manufacturers had to be held responsible for conditions like this, wage slavery, terrible working conditions, and that actually happened. Those things were changed. And this advocate also said that people who are trafficked, like these Thai nationals had been trafficked, should have a special visa to protect them. This advocate and this work drew the attention of then Governor Jerry Brown, who appointed her to several positions of significance in California's Labor Department bureaucracy. She later rose to be the Commissioner of Labor in California. Her name is Julie Hsu. She's the acting director of the Department of Labor, and that's the story that I'm linking together. Francis Perkins, Julie Sue, Labor Department, worker rights, and the rest. Julie Sue, welcome to the takeout.
Thank you very much.
Did I get anything wrong there?
That was an impressive story and linking of stories, something that I have
all
done
true.
Too. Last year, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire Memorial was dedicated in New York, and I spoke there and made the same link, so thank you very
what
much.
What do those stories tell you about the history of workers, worker rights, and the collision with free enterprise, capitalism, and the like?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think one thing it tells us is that too many workers have to work under conditions that are totally unacceptable. And in the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire case, as you mentioned, those workers were advocating for change. They were saying that the conditions were dangerous, that the exits were blocked, that they needed health and safety protections, and people didn't listen until that fire broke out, and many of them died, and they had to jump. They jumped from from that building to their death because otherwise they would have been burned. And I often think about what would have happened if people had just listened to them before the tragedy happened. So I think a lot about how in our work today, are we listening to workers when they speak, and are there things we could do to avoid a tragedy like that? Those Thai workers, just to fast forward to modern times, I recently got to induct them into the Department of Labor's Hall of Honor so they could take their rightful place as heroes who have changed labor conditions, who have raised awareness about practices that are unconscionable.
How did you hear about those conditions? How did that come to you?
So that case came about. I was working at a nonprofit organization now called Asian Americans Advancing Justice. I was fighting alongside low-wage workers, including garment workers. And that case came to me because the state enforcement agency that I would come to lead over a couple decades after that was going to do a raid on what they said was a garment factory. Now, I did not know at the time how horrible the conditions actually were, but it's a good example of how those conditions where workers were basically held in modern-day slavery aren't so much aberrations as they are like part of a spectrum of the kinds of abuse that working people have to face because of market conditions that
allow
them to be.
And their powerlessness.
And their powerlessness, right? And their invisibility. And so I was called by the state agency to say, we have a raid. We need help with people who actually speak Thai. And can you find someone for us? And that's how I knew about it. And the next day, front page news about those conditions. And I said, what happened to the workers? And they were being held in detention, about to be deported. I thought that was just...
As if they'd done something wrong.
That's right. Which is what they were told all along, that if you report us, you will be deported, you will be punished. And that's one way that exploitative employers keep workers down and keep them afraid of coming forward. And I just thought, we can't let that happen. We have to listen to them.
Kelfer, careful listeners and viewers will note that I called you acting secretary. You're not confirmed. You were recently reported out on party line vote from the Health and Education, Labor and Pensions Committee on the Senate side. What are the prospects for your confirmation?
I remain hopeful. I've appreciated the tremendous support I've received from a lot of senators, and we continue to collaborate on things, shared commitment to making life better for workers in a whole bunch of different ways. I do have a very important job to do that the president has entrusted me to, and as you heard in the State of the Union, he has great clarity about the challenges that we face as a country, domestic and global, and a very clear vision for how to meet those challenges. And it is my job to help him to deliver on that vision. And that vision, workers are very central to that. And so the role of the Labor Department and my role is especially important in an administration that is pledged to be the most pro-worker, pro-union administration in history.
Any chance you would withdraw?
No.
So the Senate's going to have to deal with you one way or the other.
I mean, I respect the process, but again, the president, I'm really honored by his support, and I feel like we are, the gains that working people have seen in this administration is partly a function of their strength and courage and their organizing and their coming to the bargaining table and making demands, but it's also because leadership matters, and this president has said worker well-being is central to a strong economy, and I'm here for that.
Have you made any headway with West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin.
No, I did see him at the State of the Union, though.
Did you say hi?
Yes, we did.
Anything else?
No, there wasn't a lot of time for more.
Honestly, what do you think the prospects are?
I think that I'm going to do this job for as long as the president wants me to do it, and as long as the American people need somebody who's going to fight for working people, who's going to, you know, wake up every day and want to make life better for working families, who's going to want to connect people to the good jobs that are being created because of the president's historic Investing in America agenda.
Have you tried to engage any Senate Republicans to help you?
When I went through the nomination, the confirmation process, I met with a lot of senators.
Right.
And, you know, again, I have great respect for the process, for their role. And, you know, we'll continue to remain hopeful while also remaining focused on the job that needs to be done. And I think the American people need a strong labor secretary. And I plan on continuing to do that for as long as I can.
That's the voice of Julie Sue. Anju is our restaurant. Dinner will be here shortly, I promise you. Well, that's just for you and I, actually. When we come back for segment two, we're going to talk about some of the issues that stick in the craw of some of the senators who are holding up Julie Sue's confirmation. I'm Major Garrett. Stay tuned for segment two of The Takeout.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome back to The Takeout. Acting Labor Secretary Julie Sue is our special guest. A couple of Republicans, more than one, have pointed to this or commentaries like this, which I came across in the Orange County Register, reading directly from a recent editorial. Julie Sue's incompetence as California's labor secretary during COVID-19 pandemic cost the state $32 billion to unemployment insurance fraud. She ought to have been fired. Your response?
Well, one of the things that COVID demonstrated was the inadequacy of many of our systems that are supposed to support working people. And the unemployment insurance system was one of them, right? This is a system that in states across the country is built on decades-old technology. There's been underinvestment for a very long time. And so when the crisis hit, it was wholly inadequate for providing the kinds of benefits that were needed. You know, I
mean,
was
the what I've read is that people got them who didn't deserve them, including people in prison, people who were not jobless and the like, and people who did deserve them didn't get them.
So the reality is that the large majority of people who were eligible for benefits and should have gotten them got them. But that's not an excuse for the fact that many people suffered greatly because the system, again, there were backlogs, it was slow. And that's why now, in my current role, my team and I are very hard at work on building a system that's going to work in the next crisis. I always say, the UI system was like a house with a leaky roof. And in good times, you could put a couple buckets under it and mostly ignore it. But in the storm, everything, all of its weaknesses get revealed.
And most of these are administered at the state level.
Yes, that's right. That's right. But it is a partnership. It's a federal-state partnership. And what we have really restored and approached it with is the idea that we should be working together to make sure that we have a system that is strong, that is accurate, that can combat fraud, but most importantly, is going to put money into workers' pockets when times are tough and they're supposed to get benefits.
Other critics of your nomination don't like the way you embraced SB 5, a bill in California that became law that essentially said gig workers should be treated. And there are some exemptions. If you're a gig worker who negotiates directly and sets prices with your consumers or your partners, that's fine. But if you're a Lyft driver or an Uber driver or DoorDash or things like that, you are an employee and deserving of all the protections that come with that as a recognized registered employee. Your response?
To be clear, AB 5 does not say that any specific industry automatically is covered as an employee. What it did was try to combat the scourge of misclassification in many industries where working people work hard at a job under the control of an employer, or the entire business is meant to do that one thing and all the people they hire do that one thing, but they're called an independent contractor and therefore stripped of a century's worth of protections like minimum wage and overtime.
Or healthcare,
workers' compensation, mm-hmm. unemployment insurance during hard times. I mean, to link the last conversation with this one reason why the system needed to put in place a whole new pandemic unemployment program was because our existing unemployment insurance system, too many people were not covered by it, in part because of misclassification. So there's connections between these kinds of abuses.
So no apologies.
Well, the goal was to combat misclassification, and I do not apologize for making sure that employees who deserve protections and the right to organize is covered under employee status, right? That those workers have those kinds of protections.
You are also on the plus side, and this is what your defenders say in the Senate, credited with helping to resolve a couple of very sticky labor issues. Shipping or dock worker strike in California and the rail strike. How did you do that?
Well, this has been a remarkable time for working people and especially for unionized workers. And that is because working people are tired of being mistreated. Workers are demanding their fair share of profits, right, of industries that they've helped to build. And we're seeing that. It's also no accident that this is happening with a president who has been very clear that the middle class built America and unions built the middle class. So unions are seeing a moment in which organizing and coming to the bargaining table and demanding fairness, this is a moment for that. And we're seeing that across multiple industries, as you suggested, from Hollywood to healthcare mm-hmm. to hospitality, from dock workers to delivery drivers, teachers to auto workers. And in certain of those instances, we look to see whether my involvement could be helpful. Mm-hmm. We rely on the parties to tell us that because collective bargaining is ultimately up to the parties.
Right, exactly.
And in certain instances, I've had the privilege of coming to the table to try to help move negotiations along. It has been a privilege to see the kinds of win-win solutions that can come through collective bargaining.
And when your Republican critics say collective bargaining is something that people should be able to opt into, but also should be able to opt out of right to work, as many states in this country recognize, and they say you are hostile to that, your reaction is?
I mean, let's look at what has happened just in 2023 alone. Working people have won, on average, double-digit wage increases just in the first year of many of these new contracts that have been achieved. Workers have also come to the table to say we should have a voice in things like the adoption of artificial intelligence, right? We should have a voice in thinking about...
We're going to get to AI in a minute, I promise.
The future of our industry, right? Working people like the UAW have opened up factories that were shuttered, and that's going to revitalize entire communities. And non-union employers have been raising wages in response to union contracts so that they can remain competitive. All of these demonstrate the benefit that unions have on our economy. And I think that you know, preserving that right, that ability of workers to organize, and then supporting the power of unions to transform workplaces and to bring about more equity, right? The gap between CEO pay and frontline worker pay is the highest it's ever been. It's not fair. And so unions are a big bulwark against that. And in President Biden's America, they're what make America strong and what's going to make America stronger.
And going back to where we started, there is a rather consistent thematic approach of business and labor in this country. Business opposes or tends to oppose more aggressive assertion of worker rights on behalf of wages, benefits, or hours.
So this is the neat thing that I have also seen in this position, is that that's not always the case, right? So employers who, you know, you get to the other side of a negotiation, I've been at the table with employers who see the benefit to them of the kind of security and stability going forward because they have a strong union and
a
good labor management relations.
Reliable workforce.
Exactly. It's retention, it's training, it's also just morale, right? Like people feeling good about their work, and many employers who feel like their job is not just to pad their bottom line, but to actually help build up the communities that they're a part of. We're also seeing companies voluntarily agree to recognize their union, for example, you know, agree to neutrality. Big companies that are doing that, and we've had them come to the Department of Labor to talk about the business case for worker voice. Those companies are saying, it is better for me if I treat my workers with respect, give them the real choice that they should have, and build my business off that kind of model. So I don't think it's definitely not a given that employers are going to oppose union organizing drives. And we're seeing companies, even in places that were thought unorganizable before, right, really vulnerable workers, recognize their workers' right to join a union. And I think that's a good thing.
But the theme I've read in the last 20 years is that unionism is dying in America.
Well, about 60 million Americans say that they would want to join a union if they knew how, or if it wasn't so hard, meaning there wasn't so much retaliation for it, right? They didn't have to risk their economic security for it. There wasn't so much retaliation, or even that it didn't take so long to get to a first contract, right? That's one of the ways that I think, you know, employers really kind of, you know, mess with the systems where their workers have already clearly chosen a union and they delay getting to a first contract. So working people want to join a union. And I think, again, you know, we're in a moment where both employers and employees are seeing why it's good for the economy. And as President Biden says over and over again, this is how we build an economy that leaves no one behind, where workers get their fair share.
If there was ever a doubt that we're in a moment, just check with Starbucks. That's the voice of Julie Hsu, the acting Labor Secretary of the United States government. When we come back from segment three of the Takeout, I'm going to ask her about a newsworthy promise the president made at a State of the Union address. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Takeout. Anju is our special restaurant. Never been here before, but I guarantee you after two or three bites, we'll be back again and again. We can see everything's arrayed before us. Beautiful. Julie Hsu is the acting Labor Secretary of the United States government. And at the State of the Union, I want to read this directly. The President of the United States, talking about the U.S. economy, said the following, and I quote, "The landing is and will be soft." True?
So 14.9 million jobs created since this president came into office. We have had an unemployment rate of under 4% for 2 years and running. It's the longest stretch in 50 years. Labor force participation remains strong for women. It's been especially strong, prime age working women. And real wages are up. That means especially for low and middle income Americans, wages have outpaced inflation. I think that all of those numbers, even if you took one or two of them, but all together, that is pretty much the softest landing that you could imagine.
The reason I ask is, though the jobs report that came out just last week was higher than economists had predicted, there were underlying revisions to the two previous months, December and January, that suggested to some economists, maybe wet blanket economists, I don't know, that there is underlying weakness in the labor market and that a recession could be coming in the next two or three quarters. How do you read that?
So people have been saying that for 3 years now. And the numbers don't lie. People have said we can't have the kind of job creation that we actually have had. We cannot bring people back in the labor market, and people are back in the labor market. We cannot both bring down inflation and keep wages high, and we have done that. And so I think the naysayers either don't want to see the numbers that they as they actually are, or are looking at something else. And President Biden's economic policies have defied expectations for 3 years and running, and the last jobs report was 275,000 jobs created. And so, again, I don't know what other kind of landing this looks like, but remember, people were saying there was going to be a crash, there was going to be a recession. Mm-hmm. We couldn't get the jobs, and once we got them, it was too hot. I think we are now, safely in a place of saying that the economic.
So when the detractors or the wet blanket economists say the labor market is softening, you disagree?
I mean, certainly we are no longer seeing the kinds of numbers from last year, right? 400,000 a month or more. But President Biden a year ago said, our plan is to get to a more steady state where we're still seeing steady, stable growth. And we're still seeing people, broad-based, right, across many sectors, which was the case in February and has been the case throughout. And that is how we will build a strong and stable economy.
You mentioned, and I think this is accurate in terms of the last year, the last 12 months, wages have outpaced inflation, but they didn't the two previous years, correct?
Yeah.
Right. So inflation writ large is still a factor, not only in terms of politics, but I'm not talking politics. I'm just talking about real wages on an hourly basis are not where they were February of 2021, the first full month of this administration.
Right.
Correct?
That's right. I mean, inflation has come down by like 2/3, right? Its peak, it was something like 9%. Now it's somewhere 3%. We'll see new inflation numbers for February. But I do think the point here has to be, I mean, the story of this economy is we came back from the wreckage of COVID, and the president bet big on the American people, bet big on the American worker. Many people said, if you do the kind of investments we're talking about in the American Rescue Plan, it's going to, right, like, it's going to be too hot. It's too much. I think the president believes, he made it clear in the State of the Union, there's no such thing as too much that's good for, too much good for the American worker. We got to do right by the American worker. And the $2 trillion in investments in infrastructure, clean energy, manufacturing is all about that too, creating good jobs, good union jobs, jobs that do not require a four-year college degree in communities all across America.
You mentioned artificial intelligence a moment ago, and I said I promise we'll get to that. Well, here we go. The investment bank Goldman Sachs recently predicted that 300 million jobs globally could be lost or diminished by artificial intelligence. I believe the number in the United States over time is upwards of 80 million, 84 million. Should workers be terrified, therefore, of artificial intelligence?
So point number one, there is nothing inevitable about AI, meaning...
There isn't.
No. Whether jobs stay...
Billions and billions are chasing it.
Whether we...
In capital markets right now.
Whether we... It's not that AI is not going to be developed. There's nothing inevitable about how it gets used and its impact on working people. Those are choices. They're choices that... They're policy choices. They are, choices that industry, employers, government are all going to make. And that's why the president issued an executive order saying, let's figure out how to make sure that AI is safe, secure, and reliable. Well, my argument is that it's not safe, secure, or reliable unless it does right by workers. And there's going to be a lot of choices that are made that we're making right now, mm-hmm. right? But there and when workers have a voice at the table about AI, it doesn't mean that AI can't be adopted.
Like
it
actors just means, or writers.
Exactly.
It That's what the whole strike was about last year.
100%. That's right.
So the reason I think people are concerned about this, and the reason I raise it, because you're one of the best people in America I could ask these questions to, the National Bureau of Economic Research has a relatively recent report that claims that 50 to 70% of changes in U.S. wages since 1980 are directly attributable to technology, and they cost at least 15% in wages for non-highly educated American workers since 1980. Those are real-world effects of things that are not linked to artificial intelligence, just basically the computer and the internet. It seems to me people are well-placed to be nervous. about the implications of this technology and the implications on the wage gap and all the things that have sort of bedeviled non-college educated workers of all races in this country since the 1980s.
So that growing gap, right, between, I meant this earlier, what CEOs make, right, tens of millions of dollars, what they make a year is, you know, more than what their workers are going to make in a lifetime. Those are not unique consequences of technology or any other change like that. And in fact, if you look at technological change, some of it has resulted in some positive changes,
sure.
Right? Like, you know, elimination of some of the most dangerous parts of work. You know, and I think we need to take the lessons from that, right? How do we think about AI in a way that can complement human creativity, human ingenuity? Again, like you said, the writers and the actors put that issue front and center and demonstrated what is possible when workers have a say and we can think about the future of industries in a way in which workers continue to benefit. I'm not saying it's going to be easy, but I am saying that there are choices that are going to be made to determine the outcomes.
What about AI teamed with robotics? That is to say, robots that handle inventory, that handle other things, driverless cars, things like that. Do these two things together represent something akin to a primal threat to workers and worker rights and worker wages?
My point is they don't have to, and they should
not. But
they
could.
They could. No question they could, right? I mean, that is, you know, many... part of the problem, I think, is that we have to design a society, this is exactly President Biden's vision, in which we take care of working people and make sure that they are able to exercise their power, their voice, you know, have flexibility, see a path to middle class, have upward mobility, all of those things. And there's no reason why AI should change that fundamental principle. So there are ways to think about AI in a way of you know, how do we complement what humans are good at? How do we, again, you know, like eliminate some of the backbreaking work that too many workers have to do while creating more opportunity in right, like to do, again, work that humans are needed for. I, you know, nobody wants a machine to be the one to break bad news to them, you know, about their health. You know, when I met with the writers during their strike, they said, you know, AI has never been to fat camp. AI has not had childhood trauma. Right. There are things about the human experience that matter. And how do we think about AI in a way that enhances those things rather than looking at it as a robot apocalypse in which workers are the only ones, you know, who are going to have to pay for it?
And who wants that, a robot apocalypse? And I guarantee you, ladies and gentlemen, artificial intelligence could never have thought up this show. Segment four, The Takeout, in just one second.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than just a car or a house. It's the four wheels that get you where you're going and the four walls that welcome you home. When you combine auto and home insurance with Amica, we'll help protect it all. And the more you cover, the more you can save. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome back to The Takeout. I don't think our table at The Takeout has ever grown more from more beautiful food arrayed around the microphones. I may be wrong about that, but I don't think so. I have a pretty good memory. Anju is our host restaurant. We appreciate their hospitality and this magnificent feast they have set before us. We'll get to it on the other side of the show because Acting Labor Secretary Julie Hsu and I want to enjoy it in its full measure. No little bites. Talk to me about a couple of things I'm curious about in American labor and workforce. I have some experience with this. My mother was in an assisted care facility the last 2 years of her life, and I came to rely more than I could possibly imagine on the skill, the care, and the compassion of not home health care workers, but people in this general area of American labor. They were well cared for as workers in this facility that my mother was in, I'm happy to say, but that's not the universal situation for this workforce. Talk to me about their needs and the future of that kind of work in America, because it's not going to go away. It will only become more important as our baby boom population continues inevitably to age.
That's right. So caregivers, whether in the home or in a skilled nursing facility, right, residential care home, are truly treasures, right? They are the people who care for those that we love. They're the ones who make it possible for those, you know, those of us who go to work.
Let's be candid. I have a stressful job, but it's a well-compensated job. I'm not like all Americans. Not everyone could afford the place I could. I could because I have a highly compensated job that makes me fortunate and blessed. But because I work very hard and it's stressful, I had to rely on these people more than I could have possibly imagined.
That's right. That's right. I mean, they become almost like, you know,
totally family members.
Exactly. And I think you highlight a very important part of this conversation, which is that those jobs have not been of the quality that we need them to be, certainly commensurate with the value that they add, but also in order to build a strong care infrastructure that will help meet the needs of working people, of families, and of the caregivers themselves. And so President Biden called for, when he first came in, a real care infrastructure in which people could afford the care they needed, and where caregivers were given the respect and dignity that they deserved. And that's still work that we need to continue to do, because that has not happened yet. That's another reason why that industry has not recovered to this pre-pandemic level the same way others have. And that's not a demand issue. As you know, this is a current demand. It's going to be a growing demand as our population ages. But it's a supply problem because the job quality is just not there.
You know, Acting Secretary Sue, when you go on TikTok or Instagram or any other social media platform, you will find people complaining about prices. And they often complain about prices outside of a Starbucks or a diner, or their food or their beverages are simply too expensive. And some people then rotate to, well, if the workers weren't paid so much, things wouldn't cost so much. Is that sustainable? That is to say, wages for service industry employees, high visibility ones, in the current economy.
So I think there is something to the argument that, of course, the connection between wages and prices. But that is not—it's not like a direct correlation or causation. Oftentimes, prices go up even when wages don't, right? So this is this is sort of the president's approach to the idea of, you know, it's a shrinkflation idea, but it's also a like price gouging. You know, one reason for inflation is that companies are taking advantage of market forces or just charging more in a way that increases their profit, but has nothing to do with workers' wages. So I want to de-link those things as necessarily connected. But in some situations, it does, you know, it is connected. And I think the answer there is, looking at the economic recovery we've had, the fact that workers make more is better for our economy, period. They have more to spend, right? Workers, especially workers who work for hourly wages, are the ones who are spending money in the small businesses in their community, right? In restaurants. They're the ones who keep the economy going. And that's why, in addition to the well-being of workers, just from economic perspective, good money in workers' pockets is a good thing.
And of the economic research that says when you inevitably raise minimum wages, you destroy jobs, you say?
It's just, I don't know. There are as many studies saying the opposite. And I think when you look at the impact of minimum wage increases in states that have them, we've seen stronger economies, more, again, local spending, people coming into those jobs, right, in this tight labor market, which is a real feature of Bidenomics. It's a way that workers get more power and get more choice. Higher wages has been how workers get recruited into jobs. It's about retention. It's about we talked about this already, worker morale. Those things, when workers are paid better and they're treated better, you have as many employers saying this as anybody else, it's better for the business too.
If I read the statistics correctly, Madam Acting Secretary, there are about 9 million unfilled jobs in America presently and about 6.5 million unemployed, right? How does that work month to month? I mean, we have this gap.
So
more job
it,
openings
that's right.
than
that's
unemployed America.
That's what the tight labor market is, right?
And highly tight.
And that is what, again, gives workers more choice, right? It gives more workers power at the bargaining table. But it's also a result of the president's historic investments in American roads and bridges. He has promised. His Investing in America agenda is about making sure that clean drinking water flows out of every faucet, that every community has access to high-speed, reliable internet. Those are not just things we want to build America, they're opportunities to create good jobs. So job creation, right? And those are the new jobs. There's also jobs, teaching jobs, nursing jobs, right? Jobs that were really hard hit during the pandemic. We've seen a push for better job quality in order to get workers there. And one of the real priorities of mine is to figure out, how we create the infrastructure to connect people who want those good jobs to those jobs. We do have to do a better job of that workforce infrastructure, and that's a lot of our investments are in that. Apprenticeship programs, pre-apprenticeship programs.
There's a knock on bureaucracy that it went too far during the pandemic and harmed business and job creation. If you could do anything, or would you have any regrets, or do you think anything should be rethought about that approach?
Well, during the pandemic itself, those were just really devastating times. I remember it clearly, right? I mean, businesses shut, workers out of work, people desperate for a lifeline.
Sometimes at the order of the government, though.
And we were all, everybody then, was working under, limited information, right? So much confusion. I remember when people couldn't even get enough masks, right? Mm-hmm. And we were still trying to figure out, were masks the answer? I think that is why we have to invest in strong systems that make up our safety net in good times. Because if they don't work during bad times, that's what happens. That's what happened with the unemployment insurance system. But I will say, in the immediate aftermath, when President Biden first came into office, his response, including to people who said, oh, you can't put too much money out into people's pockets, mm-hmm. that's gonna be a bad thing, was no, I'd rather go too big than too small here. And that has paid off beautifully in terms of the recovery.
Not in the eyes of Republican critics, but it's certainly in your eyes, Acting Labor Secretary Julie Hsu. Thanks so much for your time. Stay tuned for your Takeout Outtake Especial, because after that, we're going to eat. So we'll see you next week. Welcome to your Takeout Outtake Especial. Anjou is our host restaurant. We love their hospitality. I can already tell you I've had a couple of bites of the food. We're going to get to this in a second. Acting Labor Secretary Julie Hsu is our special guest. Thanks so much. We have three threshold questions we ask everyone who comes to the Takeout microphones. Take these questions in whichever order you prefer. Most influential book in your life and why? All-time favorite movie? And if you're going to enjoy some music on a long flight or a long drive, what artist or genre is it most likely to be?
Oh my gosh.
You've watched the show before. You're not totally surprised.
I know, but I wasn't. Okay, so, wow. I will mention the most recent book I read, which was...
Sometimes people do that.
Okay,
yeah.
It was Kim Kelly's Fight Like Hell. It's about working people, their struggles, their resilience. Phenomenal. In terms of movie, you asked me about a movie, mm-hmm. I haven't had a lot of time for movies.
This is your whole life. It just doesn't mean
all right, recent. So in my whole life, my childhood friends will tell you that my favorite movie was always Rocky. Okay. Now, it's the Rocky series.
Right.
I especially like Rocky 3, and mm-hmm. I could actually act out scenes from it. I won't do that today.
Okay.
But it's an underdog story.
Right. Yes.
And
who doesn't love an underdog story?
Right. And a story about heart, right?
Mm-hmm.
And music. So I pretty much just listen to whatever my adult children listen to mm-hmm. nowadays. But last Labor Day, I did get to make a playlist. My staff and I worked on that together, and it mm-hmm. was a lot of fun. It was everything from Dolly Parton's 9 to 5 to Beyonce. We had the Union mainstay, Solidarity Forever, mm-hmm. and we put Tracy Chapman on there. Now she's having
big comeback
a day,
performance so. at the Grammys, which I believe were on CBS. I think so. Let me go back to movies for a second. Any labor-oriented movies that you are fond of?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've watched, right? I mean, you know, Norma Rae is a movie I've seen.
You like me, you really do.
Yeah.
Sally Field. Go look it up. It's on the web, kids.
I'm also a big musical fan. My kids performed in musicals growing up.
Okay.
I've seen a lot of musicals. And, you know, Newsies is just
Yeah, Newsies, love that. Very much on the nose.
Musical.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's a great documentary. Well, I'm not sure if it's a documentary or a feature film. Mate One. About West Virginia coal miners. Excellent. Highly recommended, folks. Julie Sue, acting labor secretary, United States government. Anju is our restaurant. The food is here. We're going to eat. See you next week, folks.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Fari, Jamie Benson, Sarah Cook, Ellie Watson, Jake Rosen, and Ashley Armstrong. CBSN production by Eric Susanen. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Takeout Podcast. That's at Takeout Podcast. And for more, go to takeoutpodcast.com. The Takeout is a production of CBS News.
If you like The Takeout, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I'm Mo Rocca, and I'm excited to announce season 4 of my podcast, Mobituaries. I've got a whole new bunch of stories to share with you about the most fascinating people and things who are no longer with us. From famous figures who died on the very same day to the things I wish would die, like buffets. Listen to Mobituaries with Mo Rocca on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Survivor 46 is here, and so is On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast, and we have a twist this season. The winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares, will be joining us every week.
We're going behind the scenes of the biggest moments, the how and the why things happen, and the strategy and analysis you can only get from someone like me, a Survivor winner.
Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.